Lecture number 6, Nibbana. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. The Buddha says that he teaches only dukkha and the cessation of dukkha, suffering and the end of suffering. In the talks given so far, we've dealt primarily with the first side of the Dhamma, with the problem of suffering. However, the truth of suffering is not the final word of the Buddha's teaching. It is only the starting point, the first noble truth, not the whole of the Dhamma. The whole of the Dhamma has to be found by examining all four noble truths. So far, we've explored the negative side of the truth of suffering and its cause. In this talk and in the following talk, we'll deal with the other side, the positive side, with the third and fourth noble truth. But before doing so, it's important to understand why the Buddha starts his teaching with the truth of suffering. He starts with suffering because his teaching is designed for a particular end. It is designed to lead us to liberation. In order to do this, the Buddha must give us a reason to seek liberation. Normally, we aren't aware of the problematic nature of our existence. We live in a world of delusion. We see things as being pleasurable, attractive, permanent. We take our personalities to be a self. We live seeking pleasure, seeking to gratify and bolster the ego. We think only of how to maximize our enjoyment and our personal status. In this way, we get lost in the world of finite concerns. We get swept away by time, the current of time. We get sunk in the dark mass of ignorance. We do not realize that our lives are pervaded by dukkha. We don't see the pain and suffering, the impermanence, the insubstantiality surrounding us on all sides. To lead us out of dukkha, to bring us to the true state of peace, the peace of deliverance, the Buddha first has to alert us to the danger. He has to make us see the problem, the peril. He has to arouse in us the sense of urgency. His position is somewhat like someone trying to save a man caught unawares in a burning house. The man doesn't realize his house is on fire. He's living there, enjoying himself, watching television, playing and laughing. To get him to come out, the first thing that we have to do is to let him know that his home is on fire. So in the same way, the Buddha announces in the first noble truth that our house is on fire. Our lives are burning with old age, sickness, and death. Our minds are flaming with the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. Then when we become aware of the trouble, when we're ready to seek a way to release, then the Buddha can show us the possibility of freedom. Freedom from dukkha, from suffering, can only be attained by cutting off its cause. The principal cause of suffering, the Buddha says, is craving, tanha, the desire for personal gratification, the desire for existence, the desire for a world of sight, sound, smells, taste, touch sensations, and ideas. And since the cause of dukkha is craving, the key to reaching the end of dukkha is to eliminate craving. And therefore, the Buddha explains the third noble truth as consisting in the extinction of craving. He says, quote the text, "What now is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering? It is the complete fading away and cessation of craving. craving, its forsaking and abandonment, liberation and detachment from it. This noble truth of the cessation of suffering has two dimensions, the psychological dimension and the philosophical dimension. We'll deal with them briefly, each in turn. First, at the psychological level, we find that unhappiness, content, or suffering results from the tension between desire and the lack of the thing desired. We desire something, an object, a person, a particular situation. We do not have it, therefore we feel dissatisfied. We desire to hold on to something forever, and when we think of losing it, then we feel afraid, we feel worry and anxiety. And when we lose what we have, then we feel sorrow and grief. Thus, all suffering, all pain and dissatisfaction comes about from this conflict between desire and reality. Now, there are two possible approaches to overcoming the unhappiness that results from this tension. One is to obtain the object of desire, to secure possession of it. The other is to eliminate the desire. In both cases, the tension, the conflict is removed, and the unhappiness is replaced by pleasure or satisfaction. Now, usually we adopt the first alternative. We try to obtain the object of desire, and when we do so, we feel happy. Thus, we conclude that happiness comes from satisfying our desires. But the kind of happiness that results from satisfying our desires is very tenuous. If we examine it carefully, we find that it's unreliable, insecure. First of all, it depends on getting things outside ourselves. It depends on externals. And when we don't get the things we want, we become unhappy. We don't feel contentment in ourselves. And then in the second place, this kind of happiness requires the permanence of the object of desire. But these things that we obtain are always impermanent. And when we're separated from them, then we become unhappy. Therefore, even in the midst of happiness, in the midst of pleasure, we remain vulnerable to suffering. And so our state of happiness and pleasure, if we examine it, we find that it's really illusory, really a concealed or potential form of dukkha. The Buddha, in his teaching, reverses this common assumption that underlies all of our usual activities, the assumption that happiness can be found by satisfying our desires. He points out that true happiness is to be achieved by taking the other approach, the opposite approach. This approach is to eliminate the desire. If we eliminate the desire, then our mind remains satisfied, content, and happy, no matter what our external situation might be. We can see this to a limited extent in our daily life, how all the worry, concern, clinging, and discontent that might build up around our desire for a certain object, how all of this mental unhappiness falls away, drops away, as soon as we drop the desire, the craving for that object. But the Buddha says that the same immediately visible principle can be carried all the way through to the point of completion, that it's possible to totally uproot craving once and for all. And by uprooting all of our thirst and craving, all our blind desire, we attain a happiness, a contentment, an inner satisfaction that can never be destroyed, can never be disrupted. This is the cessation of suffering, the end of dukkha, visible here and now. But the end of dukkha has a deeper meaning even than this. We saw in the previous talk, in an earlier talk, that our craving leads us into clinging. We cling, and because of our clinging, we engage in patterns of action by which we build up karma. Then through our karma, we turn over and over again in samsara, the round of birth and death, moving through its different planes of existence, the heavenly world, the human world, the lower world. All these different planes of existence have their own kinds of dukkha, their own forms of suffering. Even the heavens are no final refuge. By achieving a heavenly rebirth, we can enjoy immensely long lives, great power, beauty, and bliss. But even those worlds, the life in those worlds comes to an end. It can be followed by rebirth elsewhere and by more suffering. Thus, to reach final happiness, full freedom from suffering, we have to get free from the cycle of existence. And this comes by uprooting craving. When craving is eliminated, all clinging stops. Our actions no longer build up karma. And then the wheel of repeated becoming is brought to a halt. That is the state of final deliverance, which is the aim of the Buddha's teaching. The state of final deliverance is called in Pali Nibbana, in Sanskrit Nirvana. The word Nirvana or Nibbana literally means the going out or extinguishing of a flame. And thus, used figuratively by the Buddha, it means the extinguishing of the flame of craving, the extinguishing of the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. The Pali writers also take the word to have the meaning of escape from the forest, that is, escape from the forest of craving, or from the forest of samsaric becoming. The state of Nibbana is the ultimate goal of the Buddhist path, the end and the consummation of the entire practice. The Buddha says that just as the waters of a river plunge into the ocean and merge with the ocean, so the spiritual path, the Noble Eightfold Path, plunges into Nibbana and merges with Nibbana. Now, when we try to talk about Nibbana, we immediately come up against the problem that Nibbana is said to be beyond the range of speech and language. Nibbana is a supramundane state, a reality which is to be seen, realized, and experienced, not a concept to be conceptualized, an idea to be discussed. Ultimately, Nibbana should be experienced and realized. However, to make known the nature of Nibbana, we have to resort to words, we have to speak about it, and therefore this lecture becomes possible. If we were to really give a very direct communication of the nature of Nibbana, we just have to stop the lecture at this point. But then those who are listening would be disappointed, so therefore I'll have to go on to speak to fill up the rest of the tape. Now the question comes up as to the nature of Nibbana, and especially the question is asked, does Nibbana signify only the extinction of the defilements and liberation from samsara, or does it signify some reality existing in itself? According to the Theravada school of Buddhism, which I see to be solidly grounded in the actual word of the Buddha, Nibbana is not only the destruction of defilements and the ending of samsara, but an actually existing reality, a reality which is transcendent to all the realms of phenomenal existence, to the entire empirical world of mundane experience. There are certain reasons which can be offered in support of this view. Here, I don't wish to burden anybody with dry scholarship, but a look at the text, at the suttas spoken by the Buddha, can help clarify for us our idea of what Nibbana is. This part might be a little bit dry, but a little bit at times difficult to follow, but I ask the listeners to try to follow it, even if they have to repeat the text. In the suttas, we find that there are certain key words that the Buddha uses to designate existing realities. These we can call ontological terms, terms with an existential meaning. These key terms are the words Dhamma, Ayatana, Dhatu, Pada, and Satya, the words are given on the list of Pali terms. We'll explain these words briefly and then show how each of them is applied to Nibbana. First, we'll take the word Dhamma. We have dealt with this word in some of its more common meanings as the teaching of the Buddha, as the truth made known by the Buddha, and as the path that leads to the realization of truth. But this word Dhamma also has a more philosophical meaning. The word Dhamma signifies the basic actualities, the existing realities, those things which bear their own natures independent of our thinking, of our conceptual processing of them. The Dhammas are distinguished from conceptual entities, those things which do not exist in fact, but only as ideas or notions in the mind. Now, all the Dhammas, the actual existences, are divided into two basic groups, the conditioned and the unconditioned. Sankata and asankata. A conditioned Dhamma is an actuality which has come into being through causes and conditions. Something which arises through the working of various conditions. The conditioned Dhammas include all the phenomena with which we are ordinarily familiar. These all fall into the five aggregates. So any conditioned Dhamma is either a material form, feeling, perception, a mental formation, or an act of consciousness. Now, all the conditioned Dhammas go through three phases of becoming. First, there's the phase of arising, then finally a phase of falling away, cessation, and in between the two, there's a phase called the tassa anyataktam. I've mentioned this before, that is the changing of that which stands, the transformation of that which persists. That is, while the conditioned Dhamma lasts, while it persists, it undergoes constant change. It doesn't remain static, but it undergoes transformation. It's in a ceaseless process of becoming. So the conditioned Dhamma has these three phases: arising, transformation, and falling away. Now, in contrast to all of the conditioned Dhammas, there is the class of the unconditioned, which is much simpler. It contains only one actuality, that is Nibbana. In contrast to the conditioned, the unconditioned is not produced by causes and conditions. And then, in contrast to the conditioned, the unconditioned has the three opposite marks. That is, it has no arising, it has no falling away, and it undergoes no transformation. And the Buddha speaks distinctly of Nibbana as a Dhamma. He calls it the supreme Dhamma, the Uttamang Dhamma. And he says, in one sutta, he says, that of all Dhammas, conditioned and unconditioned, the most excellent Dhamma, the supreme Dhamma, is Nibbana. So Nibbana is definitely referred to by this key ontological term of Buddhism, the word Dhamma. Another important ontological term used by the Buddha is Ayatana. This word usually means realm, plane, or sphere. For example, the Buddha speaks about the different planes of existence as Ayatanas. And he also speaks about the six sense faculties as the six Ayatanas. In a famous passage from the text, the Udana, the Buddha also speaks about Nibbana as an Ayatana. He says, monks, there is a realm, tadati tadayatanam. There is a realm where there is neither earth, water, heat, or air. Neither the sphere of infinite space, the sphere of infinite consciousness, the sphere of nothingness, or the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. That is the four formless realms. There is neither this world nor any other world, neither sun nor moon. This I call neither arising nor passing away, neither standing still nor being born nor dying. There is neither foothold there, nor development, nor any basis. This is the end of suffering. So we see that in this passage, the Buddha speaks of Nibbana as an ayatana, a realm or sphere. It's a sphere where there is nothing at all that corresponds to our world of mundane common experience. And therefore, it has to be described entirely by way of negative, as the negation of all finite properties. Another word frequently used in the Buddha's discourses is the word bhatu. This word most often means element. Thus the Buddha speaks of the four bhatus, the four material elements, earth, water, heat, and air. At other times he speaks of 18 elements, the six sense organs, the six sense objects, and the six kinds of consciousness. But the Buddha also speaks of another dhatu, another element. He calls this the amata dhatu, that is, the deathless element. And this deathless element is Nibbana. Thus, in one sutta, he speaks about a monk who has reached the highest level in the development of insight, where he's seeing all of the five aggregates as impermanent, as dukkha, and as insubstantial. Then when he reaches this climax of insight, his mind suddenly turns away from all conditioned dhammas, and he says that he focuses his mind upon the deathless element. And that with his mind focused on the deathless element, he reaches the destruction of the defilement. In another sutta, the Buddha speaks of the Nibbana Dhatu, the element of Nibbana, and he compares it to an ocean. He says that just as the great ocean remains at the same level, no matter how much water pours into it from the rivers, remains at the same height without increase or decrease, so the Nibbana element remains the same no matter whether many or few people attain Nibbana. If many people attain Nibbana, the Nibbana element doesn't grow fuller. If few attain, the Nibbana element doesn't become diminished. And the Buddha speaks quite concretely about seeing Nibbana, the deathless element, almost as though it were the object of an act of vision. In another sutta, he speaks of it as something that can be experienced by the body. It's an experience that so vivid, so concrete and real, that it can be described as touching the deathless element with one's own body. The Buddha also speaks about Nibbana as a paja. The word paja means a state, and the Buddha calls Nibbana the amata paja, the deathless state. Thus he says in the Dhammapada, better than living 100 years without seeing the deathless state is living one day seeing the deathless state. Another word used in the text is satya. This word means truth. Not truth as a statement, but truth as reality, as an existing reality. There's a passage where the Buddha says, that which the ignorant take to be truth, that the noble ones, the Aryans, know to be false. That which the Aryans know to be true, that the ignorant regard as false. That which is of an imperishable nature, that is Nibbana, and that is the truth known by the Aryans. So here in this passage, that which the ignorant take to be truth, to be real, is a self, an ego entity. And this the Aryans know to be false, since through their insight they have realized that all phenomena are without a self, that they're all insubstantial. And that which the noble ones know to be truth, that is Nibbana, and this the ignorant take to be false, an imaginary thing, or a vain notion. But the noble ones, the Aryans, have seen Nibbana. They've known through direct experience that it is real, the one ultimate reality that's imperishable. In another sutta, the Buddha says, that which has a perishable nature, that is false. But that which is of an imperishable nature, namely Nibbana, that is truth. And then he says in the same sutta that this is the supreme noble truth, Nibbana, which is of an imperishable nature. So all of these textual sources put together, I think, very clearly establish the view that Nibbana is an actual reality and not the mere destruction of defilement and cessation of existence. Then there's also another famous passage which I think also makes the matter very definitely clear. This is the passage in the Udana where the Buddha says, addressing the monks, he says, Monks, there is an unborn, an unoriginated, an uncreated, an unconditioned. If there were not this unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unconditioned, there would be no escape possible from the world of the born, the originated, the created, and conditioned. However, since there is an unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unconditioned, therefore escape is possible from the world of the born, the originated, the created, the conditioned. The Buddha here is saying that if there were no unconditioned reality, there would be no escape possible from the round of birth and death. The round of birth and death would go on forever. There would be no way at all to put an end to it. But the Buddha adds the positive counterpart to this. He says that there already exists an unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unconditioned. And therefore, it is possible for the mind to know the unconditioned, to realize the unconditioned, and by realizing the unconditioned, to destroy the ignorance and craving which hold us in bondage, and thereby make an end to the round of becoming, and reach deliverance from birth and death. Deliverance from the world of the born, originated, created, and conditioned. Now, since Nibbana is the precondition for this liberation to take place, since Nibbana must exist for it to be known and for liberation to take place, therefore it's evident that Nibbana cannot simply be reduced to the destruction of the defilement and liberation from the round. Those events are conditioned events. They occur in time, while Nibbana is unconditioned, without any origination, timeless. Now, one particular problem is sometimes raised over the statement that Nibbana is unconditioned. It's said that it seems contradictory to say that Nibbana is unconditioned, and yet by practicing the path you attain Nibbana. Doesn't this seem to make Nibbana something that's conditioned by the practice of the path, something that's produced by the path? Doesn't Nibbana become an effect, something not unconditioned, not causeless? Here, the contradiction is only apparent. Nibbana itself, we have to make a distinction between Nibbana itself and the attainment of Nibbana. Nibbana itself is unproduced, unoriginated. It's always existent. But by following the path, by reaching enlightenment, you realize Nibbana. By practicing the path, you don't bring Nibbana into existence, but rather you discover something already existing, something always present. We can say that the attainment of Nibbana, the realization of Nibbana, is produced by the practice of the path. But this doesn't mean that Nibbana itself is brought into being by the path. We can illustrate this by an analogy. The city of New York is presently existing, and there are highways leading into New York from all over the country. By driving along the highway, you can reach New York and enter the city. We can say that New York itself is produced by traveling along the highway. Rather, the highway gives us entrance to New York. By traveling on the highway, we can enter New York. Similarly, the path leads to Nibbana. By following the path, you reach enlightenment, and that brings the realization of Nibbana. But Nibbana itself is not created by the path. Now we can consider some of the terms and expressions used in the text as designations for Nibbana and try to treat these a little systematically. First of all, as a precaution, we have to repeat what we already said, that the nature of Nibbana cannot be understood through words or expressions, not even through a very thorough study of the text. This can only give us knowledge, book knowledge, but not the real understanding of Nibbana. To truly understand Nibbana, we have to understand it through actual experience, through realization. Words themselves can never adequately indicate the nature of Nibbana. However, in order to communicate some idea of the goal to which his teaching points, the Buddha had to resort to words and expressions, the conventional means of communication. And when he speaks of Nibbana, he uses two types of expressions. On the one hand, negative expressions, on the other, positive expressions. And to get an adequate idea of Nibbana, both types of expressions have to be considered in balance. The Buddha uses each type with a special purpose in mind. Now, if we don't take both types into account, we will come away with a one-sided picture of Nibbana. Sometimes the Buddha uses negative expressions. The Buddha's purpose here is to emphasize the supramundane nature of Nibbana, transcendental nature. From one angle, Nibbana is something which is completely above and beyond all the limited forms of the world. It can only be described by negations of the conditions of the world. Thus we find such expressions for Nibbana as we've dealt with already, the unconditioned, the unoriginated, the unborn, the imperishable, the unchanging, the unsupported, and so on. These terms all convey their meaning by a process of exclusion. That is, they negate some perceptible feature of conditioned phenomena in order to show that Nibbana is something entirely different and distinct from all conditioned states. We shouldn't make the mistake, some scholars make, of seizing upon these negative terms and then taking Nibbana to be a state of annihilation, or complete non-existence. To illustrate this error, the Buddhists speak of a certain parable or story of the story of the turtle and the fish. According to the story, there was once a turtle who lived in a lake with a group of fish. And one day, the turtle went for a walk on dry land. He was away from the lake for a few weeks. And when he returned, he met some of the fish, and the fish asked him, "Oh, Mr. Turtle, hello, how are you? We haven't seen you for a few weeks. Where have you been all this time?" The turtle said, "Oh, I was up by spending some time on dry land." Fish were a little puzzled, and they said, "Taking a walk on dry land? What are you talking about? What is this dry land?" The turtle tried to think of some expressions how to explain. He was left speechless. And the fish started asking questions. They said, "Well, this dry land of yours, is it wet?" The turtle said, "No, it's not wet." "Well, is it cool and refreshing?" "No, it's not cool and refreshing." "Does it have waves and ripples?" "No, it doesn't have waves and ripples." "Can you swim in it?" "No, you can't swim in it." So the fish said, "Well, it's not wet, not cool, you can't, if it has no waves, you can't swim in it. So this dry land of yours must be complete non-existent. Just an imaginary thing, nothing real at all." The turtle said, "Well, maybe so." And he left the fish and went for another walk on dry land. And so, to sum up, one method for making known the nature of Nibbana by means of negative expressions is to eliminate all the attributes of mundane conditioned phenomena to show that they are all incommensurate with the nature of Nibbana, to show that Nibbana utterly transcends all the attributes of mundane things. Another purpose behind the use of negative expressions is to show the desirability of reaching Nibbana, to indicate the benefits of attaining Nibbana. To this end, the Buddha uses a different set of negative expressions. Whereas the first set is rather abstract and metaphysical, this set is very concrete and experiential. Here, the Buddha speaks of Nibbana primarily in terms negating suffering. He holds up Nibbana as the cessation of suffering, dukkha nirodha. Thus it becomes the ideal goal, the aim of all striving, since all beings desire to be free from suffering, to be secure and free from sorrow. Then the Buddha uses terms which negate particular forms of suffering. He calls it the cessation of old age and death, the unafflicted, the unoppressed, the sorrowless state, sokha tadra, the fearless state, abhaya, the deathless state, amata. By using these terms, like the cessation of suffering, the Buddha awakens in us the aspiration to attain Nibbana. Then once he's awakened this aspiration, the next step is to point out what has to be done to reach the goal, to show the work that we have to do to arrive at the end of suffering. And to make this plain, the Buddha describes Nibbana by terms negating the defilements, negating the mental factors that keep us in bondage. Sometimes the defilements are summed up in the word craving or tanha, the cause of suffering. And so Buddha calls Nibbana the destruction of craving, tanhakaya. Sometimes the defilements are said to be the three, greed, hatred, and delusion. And so Nibbana is termed the destruction of greed, the destruction of hatred, the destruction of delusion. In other places, Nibbana is called dispassion, the raga, the removal of thirst, the crushing of pride, the uprooting of conceit, the extinction of vanity, the eclipse of ignorance, and so on. These terms all show the work that has to be done to reach the end of suffering. They show the direction in which we have to move and the task we have to accomplish. To reach the goal of Nibbana, it is necessary to destroy greed, hatred, and delusion, to eradicate craving, to uproot conceit, to abandon ignorance. And so the three purposes behind the use of negative terminology by the Buddha sum up is first, to show that Nibbana is transcendental, that it's utterly beyond all conditioned phenomena and quite distinct from them. Secondly, to show that Nibbana is desirable, that it's the end to all states of suffering. And third, to show that Nibbana is to be attained by eliminating the defilement, by uprooting all the unwholesome mental factors. Now, because the Buddha uses this negative terminology for Nibbana, some people are inclined to misapprehend it and take Nibbana to be a state of near annihilation, a purely negative attainment. To exclude this misinterpretation, the Buddha also describes Nibbana in positive terms. Some of these terms emphasize in positive ways the desirability of Nibbana. Thus, Nibbana is called the unexcelled, the supreme, the final goal, the ultimate. All these terms hold up Nibbana as the highest ideal and ultimate aim of aspiration. However, these terms are rather abstract. More concretely, in terms more accessible to us, the Buddha says that Nibbana is the supreme happiness, paramam sukham. It's the state of perfect health, free from the sickness of the mental defilement. It's perfect bliss, peace, serenity, liberation, freedom, emancipation, purity. All these terms signify qualities that we ordinarily desire and wish for. And all of these are found raised to a superlative degree in Nibbana. Then there are other terms which stress the uniqueness and profound nature of Nibbana. These terms tend to appeal to the intellectually inclined disciples rather than to the emotionally inclined ones. The Buddha says that Nibbana is the unique, something without a parallel among all other things. He says that it is the truth, the supreme truth, its reality, the profound, the subtle, the difficult to see, the difficult to understand. It's the wonderful and the marvelous, acharyam abhutam. But when these positive terms are taken over to describe Nibbana, it should be understood that these terms are used in an expedient rather than in a literal manner. That is, though Nibbana is spoken of as peace, happiness, health, freedom, and so on, we shouldn't understand these terms to mean exactly the same thing that they mean in our ordinary mundane context. Rather, these terms are used as pointers, as road signs, as expedient means to make Nibbana somewhat intelligible to us. They indicate, in terms of our ordinary experience, the direction in which we're to seek Nibbana. They indicate the qualities of common experience that are to be found in Nibbana, raised to a superlative pitch, carried to the ultimate limit. Nibbana is the pinnacle of happiness, peace, and freedom, the ultimate consummation in which all of our yearnings for happiness, for peace, for freedom, find their complete fulfillment.